You're listening to ReachMD XM233, the channel for medical professionals. In the 1950s and 60s, psychoanalysis was all the rage. It was cool to be on the couch. It was a status symbol of wealth and celebrity. What happened? Did the era of quick fixes and polypharmacy make it all irrelevant? Can it survive? Welcome to the Clinician's Roundtable. I'm your host, Dr. Larry Kaskel. Joining me today is Dr. David Turman, the director of the Chicago Institute for Psychoanalysis. Dr. Turman is extremely well-published and has been a practicing psychiatrist for 43 years. Welcome to the show, Dr. Turman.
Thank you, Dr. Kaskel.
So what did happen? What's happened from the 50s and 60s to 2007 that has made psychoanalysis less popular?
I think there have been a number of factors that have made it less popular. One of them, I think, has been the advent of psychopharmacology and of effective medications to help treat the sufferings of many people. Antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, better and better such medications, I think, have helped people and have led to the feeling that somehow one needn't have a prolonged exploration of one's inner life. And in fact, one can expect relief from symptomatic problems almost right away. And so I think that's one element.
I'd like to attack that because you can get immediate relief of symptoms, as you can stop a wound from bleeding if you put a pressure bandage on it or a nice Band-Aid. But have you done any significant change in the person's underlying behavior or understanding? And as you know, these drugs don't last forever. There's a nice little honeymoon period, and 6 months later, they're acting out again and going back to their same old repetition compulsion, if you will. So, you know, it sounds to me like you're saying, yeah, these drugs are great. They're actually helping people. But I'm curious if you really think that they're as good as they say they are.
I think you're quite right. They're not as good as they say they are. However, your question was about what are some of the cultural changes that have led to people turning away from longer-term, more intensive treatment. And I think the image or the fantasy of a quick amelioration of their difficulties, I think, is one of the things. And further, that there's relatively little to be learned or understood from a longer process of self-investigation and entering into a relationship with another person, which can be very, very difficult and very fraught for people.
Relationships are quite difficult,
yes.
Quite complicated.
Yes.
Why indeed. Is that? It's all my mother's fault.
Well, relationships are difficult, and of course, it your mother, I'm sure, did the best she possibly could.
That's what she says.
Well, she's probably right.
But, you know,
there are very few villains in the piece. It's often people do the best they can, and in the process of trying to do the best they can often do dreadful damage.
Parents always say, you know, we did the best we could, but did they really? I mean, were they really conscious and present in the situation when they were raising kids, say, 40 years ago? Were they really focused on the children's needs? It seems like 40 years ago, kids were, you know, just kind of to be seen but not heard from. The way we parent these days is dramatically different. Our children come first before anything else. We will never miss a tennis match or anything for fear that they will end up in therapy. So when our parents say we did the best we could, but I don't think they did such a great job. I think they could have done better.
Well, I'm hesitant to indict any parent or any parental generation. I think we're going to see how well we have done in this generation when our children grow up.
I'm actually saving it for a trust fund just in case I screwed up my kids. I've put some money aside for their therapy.
Well, good idea, because in spite of the best intentions that any of us has, it's in part a crapshoot. It in part depends on the meshing of the child's developmental needs and the parent's character. And parents do the best they can with their characters. Sometimes, it can be truly dreadful what they do given the nature of the child's developmental needs. For example, a kind of a depressive parent of one gender or another, when confronted with a very lively, bouncy boy or girl, may always be responding by trying to damp the child down, being overwhelmed by the child and not really liking the bounciness very much. And so the child gradually, say, theoretically damps him or herself down and grows up kind of depressed and feeling like there's not a lot of energy and that whatever his or her own inclinations are not very interesting or very worthwhile and comes to see us. Now,
Did you watch the video of my childhood? I thought I was so special that my parents couldn't handle my emotional spectrum and that the words of don't get carried away, don't get carried away. And thus, I did retreat into a very narrow spectrum of feeling.
Right, right. Well,
so I guess it's pretty common.
It is pretty common. And so is the converse. That is where you have, say, a more phlegmatic child and the parent is bouncing off the walls in various ways, very energetic, and repeatedly traumatizes the child because the child can't deal with the stimulation that the parent is bringing. And again, none of this is malevolent. None of this is motivated, say, oh, I'm going to find a way to make this child miserable and to really, really interfere with who he or she is. But it happens because of the character.
It seems to me that psychoanalysis likes to live in the past, that to understand where you are today, you have to kind of dissect and go back and unearth the scab, if you will. And last night, just surreptitiously, I attended with a friend a landmark forum meeting. You ever heard of that?
No,
the Landmark Forum.
It's
an educational group that does a 3-day intensive therapy. It's a recreation of EST.
Oh.
So now it's called Landmark.
Oh.
And their whole premise is that you have to let go of the past, completely unburden yourself completely, and get rid of all your negative thinking, everything you've ever thought before, and just let it go. And then you are what they call you've popped, and you no longer see the world the same way anymore. And so I attended this last night with my friend, and it was like being in Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go back when they offered me water,
exactly,
because I was afraid to drink the Kool-Aid,
exactly.
But yet, you know, I'm curious if there's ever been a study looking at the effect of short-term therapy, which I would say this is 3-day therapy, versus 15-year therapy of psychoanalysis. I know it was a long question, but there it is.
Well, yes, there aren't studies comparing short-term therapy with long-term therapy, but there are studies of various kinds of short-term therapy and various focused kinds of short-term therapy. In fact, there was a study published recently, I think in February, in the American Journal of Psychiatry that examined short-term therapy for panic disorder versus a more supportive general therapy. And it was surprisingly extremely effective for the panic disorder. It was a very, very powerful study. So, and there are attempts at short-term adaptations of psychoanalytic treatment, which seem to be useful in reducing the symptoms and have some staying power for in the follow-up for several years. In terms of the sort of experience that you describe in the landmark therapy, it is, as you said, it's a cultish, religious, brainwashing kind of experience. Mm-hmm. One can't just do that because you don't have access to that kind of experience. So you can't just let it go because you don't have the access to it in the first place. And it's some kind of mass hypnotic suggestion. Rian, you're quite right that can lead to any kind of untoward activity.
Well, we've free associated a lot here today. Kind of wrap things up for us, what you see for the future of psychoanalysis. Is it going to survive, and what you think will help it survive?
Of course, I think it will survive. I think it's one of the most essential endeavors in human culture. Why? Because this is a unique window onto our own inner beings. It's a unique window into human psychology. There is nothing to compare with it, nothing to compare with the depth or intensity of a psychoanalytic exploration. Drugs don't do it. PET scans don't do it. It's interesting to know about some of the hardware, if you will, on which this software lives. But it's essential for us to have this in-depth understanding of the human psyche, of the human psychology. So I think we need it. I think we have to have it. I think we'll continue to need it, and it will be essential. Will it be popular and widespread? I don't know. I think it's applications. It's applications are already very, very popular. I think that it will always be a kind of basic science of psychology, a basic science that we will need to continue to explore and which will inform everything we do.
I am a general internist, which means I'm mostly a psychiatrist. 80% of my practice is depression, anxiety, and or somatization disorders. I know that to be an analyst, a psychiatrist has to go through his own analysis, which makes him a better analyst. Mm-hmm. Do you think that physicians would be better physicians if they went through either an entire analysis or a partial analysis, or at least looked into what analysis is? Would it make them a better physician?
Oh, without question, I think it would make them a better physician. It's interesting that you raise that, because I think that we used to have liaison psychiatry, in which psychiatrists went and discussed what patients were feeling and what the meanings of their illness and their symptoms were. And I don't think that happens very much anymore. But there was an article, I think it was in Cranes, in which doctors were reprimanded for trying to make connections with their patients by talking about themselves. And they talked about themselves so much that they obscured the patients.
It was in yesterday's New York Times.
Was it in yesterday's New York Times?
Chatty doctors sometimes forget patients.
Right, right. Okay.
Actually, it was in the June 26th New York Times. There was a study that says chatty doctors sometimes forget patients, that building rapport is seen going off track.
Right. And that's precisely right. And it was very interesting to read that. And I think partly it's a result of the filtering down of misconception about what it takes to be empathic with another person. And that is that you try to share some of what that person is feeling and show them that you feel it too. It's a filtering down of that and an oversimplification and a misuse of it. But such things happen frequently. And I think one way to be able to understand and deal with patients and your interactions and what they're feeling is to know yourself. So I think analysis would be very, very useful for many, many physicians. Unfortunately, very few have it.
You mentioned know yourself. I'm pretty sure that comes from the Oracle of Delphi.
Well, I think it came from Socrates, right?
Okay. Yeah. So I know it was written over the oracle's doorway.
Okay.
Know thyself.
Right.
So what happens if you don't know yourself? I mean, what is so great about knowing yourself? They say the unexamined life is not worth living.
Yes.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you very much for coming into the studio. Our guest has been Dr. David Terman, the director of the Institute of Psychoanalysis in Chicago. I'm Dr. Larry Kaskel, and you've been listening to the Clinician's Roundtable on ReachMD XM 233, the channel for medical professionals. For comments and questions, send your email to xm@reachmd.com, and thank you for listening.